Welcome back to the program. If any movement has defined our time, it is the movement toward bigness in both government and business. In fact, the Occupy movement is protesting against the rising power of business, while the Tea Party movement protests the rising power of government. They are indeed two sides of the same coin. In many ways, this could have been predicted as globalization and multinationals began to rise in the 70s. In fact, in many ways, it was predicted. Listen to this clip from the movie Network, made 36 years ago.
And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
You get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
We're going to talk about this dramatic power rivalry today with my guest, David Rothkopf. He's an internationally acclaimed author. His previous book was Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. It is my pleasure to welcome David Rothkopf to this program to talk about his newest work, Power Inc., the epic rivalry between big business and government and the reckoning that lies ahead. David Rothkopf, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, and that was the best introduction that I've had during the course of this whole book tour.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to have you here. One of the things that becomes clear is that this rivalry, and as you even talk about it early on in the book, quoting Lincoln, quoting others, this balance of power between business and government has been around for a long time. Is there something fundamentally different about it today?
I think there are several things that are fundamentally different. I think it's important to note, though, that this tension that has, as you noted, mobilized the Tea Party movement, mobilized the Occupy movement, has been around, as you observe, since the beginning of time. You know, the two big competing organizations for the first 1,000 years of the modern era were the church and the state. And when that was resolved, there was this kind of new force that was brought to bear almost immediately, which was private power. And over the course of the 500 or 600 years since then, it has grown and grown and grown. Now, within countries, we have found mechanisms to balance out the concentration of private power, regulators, oversight mechanisms, systems of laws, and so forth. At least we've attempted to. I think it has been a bit of a losing battle. But what's different today is that on the global stage, we don't actually have those mechanisms anymore. So if you've got global derivatives markets or you've got global commons like the environment you can't put into place the kind of regulations or oversight that you do in a country. And many of these big global corporations today have more resources than most countries, and that's another change. There are probably 2,000 companies out there that have more financial resources or more political resources or greater global reach or more employees than 100 or 150 of the world's countries. And so that's changed the global order so that private players have as much power or more power than a lot of the public players.
In some respects, it is the whole being more than the sum of its parts. As you say, that within individual countries, there's this ongoing balance, this ebb and flow between where the power lies. In some cases, it's been more government power. In some cases, as we see in a lot of places now, a lot more private power. And yet, the global picture today is more than the sum of those individual parts in each country.
Yes, and it's constantly in flux. And I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that when the public-private balance goes out of whack, as it has in the United States and led to growing inequality, a system that seems to work for a smaller and smaller portion of the population, then trouble tends to ensue over history. And we can't assume that our brand of capitalism, which was kind of the light of the world and we thought at the end of the Cold War was going to be the formula for the evolution of the rest of the world, is going to prevail as a system because there are other versions of capitalism out there that have a different balance that seem to be working better, providing a higher quality of life, more justice, stronger social safety nets, many of them growing faster economically and being run in a much more fiscally responsible way.
And the sense is that while everything is changing, and certainly changing at dramatic speeds, which I want to come back to in a moment, that in fact the system seems to want to hang on to the old ways of doing things, at least our system.
Well, it's not the system in the sense that, you know, there's no sort of great brain in the sky that's, you know, doing this. It's individual actors with a lot of power, growing power, who have institutionalized some of their interests in a way that it gives them ongoing control over the system. So if you've got a political system that requires a candidate for president raise hundreds of millions of dollars, inevitably the people who've got the most money are going to have the most influence on that system. If you've got a political system where congressional districts are gerrymandered and general elections don't matter, only primaries matter, then the extreme wings of the two parties will have more influence, and the people who fund those wings will have more influence. If you've got a system where big businesses have determined that gridlock is more in their interest because it sort of takes government out of the way and allows them to operate more freely, and the government is dependent on them for money and they can go and promote this kind of polarized and thus frozen system, you're going to be stuck with this, and it's going to be very, very hard to change.
Does the speed of the system, the speed of information, the speed of technology, does all of that make it much harder for any system, any country, to self-correct today?
Yes and no. Technology should accelerate the ability of countries to be nimble as well. The problem is that countries are restricted within their borders, whereas corporations are designed to operate globally. Countries need to, in the case of democratic countries, periodically go back to the people to get a mandate with their direction. That takes time. Companies can make decisions in a boardroom much more quickly than that. And even when social upheaval takes place, what that tends to do is it throws the system into a kind of crisis, as we've seen in the Middle East and elsewhere. Special interests and others step in, and you end up with ineffective governance rather than rapidly changing governance.
The other thing that it does is because people are afraid and because the change is happening so rapidly and there's so much going on, whether it's corporate or otherwise, that is unmoored in many respects, it creates an opportunity for demagogues and for others as well to foster a greater sense of tribalism, which is counterproductive to trying to right the system.
Absolutely, and that happens on both sides, and that's why, you know, we have this kind of absurd Orwellian discussion in the United States, four legs good, two legs bad, business is bad, government is bad. You know, you've got, you know, Ron Paul making these kind of absurd claims that, you know, if we just get government out of the way, freedom will sweep in, as if you just got government out of the way, little guys everywhere would be empowered. The problem is that when you get government out of the way, the people who step in or the entities that step in tend to be big and empowered ones, and the little guys are actually shoved farther away from the table. And furthermore, when you get government out of the way, you are hurting most of all the segments of society that are most dependent on government for social support, poor people. And finally, in the United States, most of our growth over the course of the past couple of hundred years has been fueled by a special kind of public-private partnership. And the people who say, get government out of the way so that we can flourish, are ignoring the fact that when the country was knit together with canals and railroads, that was a public-private partnership. When it was knit together by the internet or the highway system, that was a public-private partnership. The growth of venture capital in the United States, the growth of new technologies that fueled the recent growth in the United States was a result of public-private partnership, government funding, and so forth. And so there is no world of one without the other, or unless you, you know, end up in the Soviet Union, and we saw what happened there. So this is, this, you know, the problem, as you say, is that the issue gets demagogued, and the people in the United States end up getting trapped.
Is there a tipping point somewhere where the power of corporations, private power, as it were, becomes so entrenched that it's impossible for the government to ever get back to a balancing point?
Well, I don't think it's ever impossible, and in fact, I certainly hope not for the point of view of the United States. I think what we have seen over the course of the past 30 years is that so much of the traditional power, public power, has been co-opted by special interests in the United States, that we now have a system in which, you know, instead of the invisible hand sort of looking out after social needs, as market theorists believe that it does, we have the invisible giant thumb on the scales tilting things in the direction of the 1%, so that last year, you know, the first year of this recovery, 93% of the benefits went to the top 1% of the population, 7% table scraps went to everybody else. The 99% of Americans last year, you know, made an average increase in their salaries of $80. The top 1% saw their salaries increase an average of almost 12%. So something is fundamentally wrong in this system. And yet you do have people going out saying, oh, no, we need to have tax relief for the rich. Otherwise, you know, we can't create jobs, or we need to, you know, get back, cut back on government regulation, even though that's precisely what led to the problem that we had with Wall Street.
Come back to this idea of the competing forms of capitalism that we're seeing today and what that should tell us.
Well, I mean, it can tell us a number of things. One, it, you know, we can learn from some of these systems, and two, it may tell us where the future of capitalism is going, because it's quite likely, if you follow history, that, you know, when the center of economic gravity moves, so does the center of intellectual gravity, and as it moved from Europe to the U.S., we became the leading sort of model for the world, and as it's now moving from the U.S. off to Asia, we need to look in that direction to see perhaps what the shape of policies and values that are shaped this century are likely to look like. But, you know, I mean, you can go out there and you can find different, divergent approaches to capitalism in Europe or in Asia, capitalism with Chinese characteristics, democratic development capitalism in countries like India and Brazil, in small states like Singapore, the UAE, or Israel, kind of entrepreneurial capitalism where the states act a little bit like countries. They're so nimble and able to respond. And in all of these cases, you'll find a bigger role for the government, an assumed role, whether the government's job is seen to be and to enhance competitiveness, or as in the case of Singapore, where the finance minister said the government's job is to empower people to seize opportunity, that, you know, in all these cases, there's an assumption that there's a bigger role for government in this partnership than there currently is in the U.S. political debate.
And that's your last point is a critical one, that we're not even having the debate, that we've lost the discussion even in terms of what the possibilities might be.
Yeah, I think, you know, the problem in the United States is that instead of having a political debate, we have a reality TV show. We, you know, it's a food fight.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides making extreme threats to the other, when in reality, both sides, Democrats and Republicans, are dependent on the money in the system and tend to promote establishment views at the end of the day. You know, if Mitt Romney and Barack Obama were a Venn diagram, there would be 70% overlap in the middle of it.
Talk a little bit about globalization and the possibility or the reality of regional and global institutions emerging from all of this that, that do have some significant power.
Around the world, you've got highly concentrated private power, big organizations. You know, take an issue like climate change. Who do you think is going to have a bigger influence over the outcome of climate change, Exxon or Sweden? Exxon has offices in more places in the world than Sweden has embassies by 2 to 1. Exxon spends more money from its budget influencing political outcomes than Sweden has discretionary money in the budget of its foreign ministry. But Exxon is one of a couple thousand companies that are able to operate without real sort of national affiliation, shifting their alliances and using their political clout to influence global outcomes or to persuade countries to change their tax codes or change their regulatory codes. And at the end of the day, they're the big job creators. You know, Walmart employs more people than a couple of dozen countries have citizens.
What that means, then, in terms of how we reassess where power really comes from. I mean, traditionally, power has been associated with force, with military force, with some kind of force. Now power is really associated with economic power.
Well, power is associated with military force if people are willing to use military force. We've had a number of developments which are essentially been good for humanity, which have shifted the balance. One of those developments is the rule of law and international institutions, which enable countries to work out their differences without force. Another, which is kind of a darker one, is that the cost of using force in real conflict because of weapons of mass destruction has gone to be so high that you don't have as many wars. Well, if force is taken off the table, then you move into the whole range of soft power kinds of tools that are available to countries or to private actors, and almost all of those depend on money. And so then it becomes a kind of an economic contest, and in an economic contest, a lot of these big private actors have an edge over a lot of governments, and because they're designed to be global and governments are kind of trapped within their borders given the nature of nation states, they have another advantage on top of that.
Within the context of corporations today, as we see corporations becoming flatter, less hierarchical than they traditionally have been, what does that mean for these equations that we've been talking about?
I think ultimately that's a good thing, but I think that it's only part of the solution. I think, you know, we need to come up with mechanisms for global governance that don't exist. I think we need to come up with public-private partnership mechanisms that don't fully exist. But I also think that, you know, sometimes hierarchy versus, flatter structure is not the core issue in the case of, you know, governments like the United States, where although we could do with a lot of flattening, a lot of the problems that we have are associated with the flaws in our finance system, and a growing institutionalization of the power of the few, you know, through things like the Citizens United decision, which at the end of the day, rewrites the idea of free speech to say that if you have more money than I do, then you have more speech than I do, or a right to more speech than I do, those kind of institutional character changes are the real threat here.
Are we going to see corporations, private power, have to take on some of the functions, some of the social functions that governments have traditionally taken on?
Well, they are to some extent. Big companies, train people. Most education systems are, based on a real antiquated approach that people go to, are trained until they're 20, 21 years old. And then not again over a 50, 60-year career. Most of that education is conducted you know, by the private sector after that. A lot of social needs are met by them. But having said that, you know, we tend to, particularly in the United States, overstate some of this. You know, there's a lot of talk about corporate social responsibility, but the average company spends 0.01% of its revenues on corporate social responsibility, and when it does, it tends to be a PR stunt. We talk about private philanthropy, and while private philanthropy can make a big impact on society, the Gates Foundation puts as much money in the field as the World Health Organization, it's not actually accountable to anybody, and it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what's needed. And at the end of the day, you want social needs being provided by an organization that actually reports to the people, which is to say government.
And, of course, part of the debate, and we're going to hear a lot more of it as this campaign unfolds, that government needs to be run more like a business.
Well, look, I mean, you want government to run efficiently. You don't want to waste money. Our country is bankrupt. And so if we could flatten it out, if we could get people out of it, if we could reduce the number of cabinet departments, that's part of the solution. But it's certainly not the whole solution, right? I mean, the biggest suck on our discretionary income is the Defense Department. You know, the United States of America has made a decision that we are going to spend more money on defense out of our discretionary dollars than anything else. We think that's our competitive edge in the world. That's clearly a mistake. That's going to have to change. We are going to need to have more revenue. You know, one of the things that you said at the very beginning, which sort of raises a little red flag, I understand why you said it, but it's a bit of a misconception, is that government in the United States is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and Republicans love to talk about the percentage of GDP that government eats up. But most of that percentage of GDP and most of that government spending is healthcare, retirement spending, it's entitlements, it's things where there isn't actually any discretion being used by the government. It's not actually a manifestation of government power. It's a manifestation of social functions being taken care of via the mechanism of government. So you can have a big government budget without actually having a powerful government intruding in a lot of people's lives.
How does it impact and how does this debate relate to smaller entities of government, state governments, municipal governments? How do they fit into this larger equation we're talking about?
Well, they're all pieces of the puzzle. In a place like the United States, where the federal government is bankrupt and doesn't have as much money as it once did, more responsibility falls on the states and localities. Unfortunately, in the case of the United States, the states and localities are actually often in worse financial shape. There is this kind of side debate that goes on in the United States where some people say, well, we should give more power to the states. I'm not sure why they believe or whether they're, you know, I mean, there's no evidence to support the idea that somehow states make wiser decisions than the federal government does. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest the contrary is true. So, you know, they are in the mix. And, you know, I would say, you know, in one thing that we've seen is that, you know, America's governors certainly understand globalization and the need to compete for foreign direct investment better than some people in the federal government do, because they recognize that ultimately they depend on inflows of cash. And so they've got to go out and find it. And if it's not coming from Washington, they'll look anywhere in the world to get it.
And that is one of the ironies of this conversation. As private institutions become larger and more global, as globalization comes along, as we have to be more competitive with other places in the world, as we've talked about, this discussion that goes on that somehow we need to deconstruct government and go back to and look at the smallest levels of government seems so anachronistic within the larger reality.
Right. It's certainly not our greatest weakness. Our greatest weakness is that we need to create, at the global level, governance mechanisms that are essential to meeting the sort of basic terms of the social contract, which, frankly, can't be met without them. And we, you know, we're at one of those moments in history where our institutions and our laws are not actually aligned with our needs. But having said that, there are a lot of, you know, anachronistic concepts at play here, and there's, you know, a lot of the discussion has to do with sort of historical, you know, feelings that have built up over time and almost a kind of a theology of one party or a theology of the other, rather than kind of an eyes wide open assessment of what the situation is now and how we've got to adapt to this new reality.
Which brings us back really to the beginning of Power Inc. And what does history tell us in terms of giving us some clues as to the way this debate may play out right now?
Well, I mean, I think one thing history tells us is that because it's been going on a long time and because private power has over a long time institutionalized many of the advantages that it has, that these, you know, artificial persons now have in the United States as many or in some cases more rights than regular people, that these are now enshrined in the law thanks to the Supreme Court, that it's going to take some real hard work over a long period of time to reverse that. We also see that when the needle swings too far in the direction of government or too far in the direction of private power, you get inequity or you get faltering economy and widespread suffering, and neither of those two things are good. I think what we have to do is we sort of have to go back to square one and learn from the moments in history when the rules didn't line up with the reality and say, what is the reality now? How is it? What is it on the global stage? What is it on the national stage? And how do we have to reform our institutions and our laws to harness what comes from markets that is good and ensure that the purpose of our society, which is not to create wealth, but really to create justice and opportunity and higher quality of life, is being satisfied through public mechanisms that capture and direct growth in ways that is in the interest of everyone, as opposed to just a handful of people.
David Rothkopf. His book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. It's just out from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.